For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
And welcome. Tonight we have one of our Sangha talks. So Guru Ross, who is the Urban Conservation Director of the Field Museum and also now Chair of our Fundraising Committee here at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, amongst many other things. Laurel's going to speak to us tonight. So thank you very much, Laurel, for agreeing to do this.
Okay, well, that gives me the opportunity to make a pitch for money. Thank you. Tygon has been talking about Buddha nature for the last few weeks, and yesterday he sort of made the transition to talking about Mother Nature, the Mother Nature part of Buddha nature, and I thought I would talk about that tonight, sort of by way of a little background about me. My livelihood is I'm a conservation ecologist, and so an ecologist is someone who studies ecosystems, studies natural communities, and looks at all the parts of those communities, the soil and the soil organisms and the plants and the pollinators and the mammals that eat the plants and the wind that blows the seeds and the water table and all the parts that make the one, which sounds really Buddhist. but a conservation ecologist or a conservation biologist is different. It's the intention is to look at those systems like a scientist, as a scientist would look at them, but with the intention of conserving them. Saving them, preserving them, in many cases restoring them, because in our world today there are some serious stresses to them. So it's a very human connection to ecosystems or Mother Nature, and it's an active, positive intention toward that nature. So a lot of what I end up doing is trying to figure out ways to connect people with nature, because if nature needs people, especially, well, I should say, so we live in Chicago, we live in the Chicago region, and we have some pretty spectacular nature here, believe it or not. And if you look at it from the point of view of global conservation, we have some places here that are the only remnants left on the whole planet. And so arguably worth the effort to save. So in our forest preserves, in our state parks, hundreds of thousands of acres of prairies and oak woodlands and wetlands and so forth. Actually talked about them for a whole hour last year at a Peace and Environment Forum, and I could do that tonight, but I'll try not to. So the idea is that there are stresses on these natural areas, and they come from things like invasive species. Climate change is a monster that's really stressing things, and so in order to work to conserve them, you have to build people's connection because you need political will to do that. And so I found that a lot of people aren't so connected with nature. It's an interesting interesting endeavor to try to figure out what is it that gets people to really feel part of it. Like it is important. It has real value to them. And in my view of it, there's nothing different between us and nature. We're made of exactly the same stuff. But people do feel that separation. So I thought I'd talk about that tonight by bringing a poem that I really appreciate. I found this poem last winter when it was really dark and really cold. So I Googled Summer and Mary Oliver. She's one of my favorite poets. And I got this really wonderful poem called The Summer Day, which I don't know, it was February or something. So I'm just going to read it first. And I brought copies that I'll give you later if you want one. But I'll just read it from beginning to end. And then I thought I could just start at the beginning and say a few things about how I feel about it, and then maybe you can tell me what you feel about it. So Mary Oliver published in 1992, The Summer Day. I have to say, I've read this poem hundreds of times. When I first got it, I wrote it out by hand and put it on my refrigerator, where it still is on my refrigerator. But I never really read it out loud, so I practiced yesterday. It's daunting to read a poem that is profound out loud, so I'll do my best. The Summer Day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean, the one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who's eating sugar out of my hand, who's moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who's gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I've been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? So that's quite a poem. It's sort of risky to talk about something that beautiful, but it's sort of like talking about Bach. You know, do you spoil it by talking about it? But anyway, we'll give it a shot. So, I mean, I think she really engages us. I was talking about engagement, and she really engages us. I mean, she starts out by asking questions, you know, who made the world? I don't know about that question. It's like nobody can make a black bear or a swan or a grasshopper. It's almost a jarring question to me, sort of a question about dual, you know, is a maker and a thing that got made. But then when she says, this grasshopper. So, I mean, people do ask that question, who made, you know, the world, but this grasshopper. So to me, there we're sort of thrust into intimacy. We're talking about this creature that she brings us very close to. I mean, it flung itself out of the grass. And then later in the poem, she's going to kneel into the grass. So we're sort of crossing those. We're just noticing that there's nothing to cross, right? It's the grass. But she makes us see this animal. I mean, the words are, if the animal is eating sugar out of her hand. That's really sort of, and moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down. And I mean, that takes some real paying attention. She says she knows how to pay attention. I don't know how you could be compassionate if you're not actually seeing the rest of what is in nature. So I so appreciate her sort of leading us to seeing this beautiful little thing that seems so relatable while it's eating sugar, and then it flaps its wings and flies away, which isn't very relatable to us, but very beautiful anyway. So, I mean, I would have been happy if the poem had stopped there. Just gazing around with enormous and complicated eyes. I actually looked up grasshopper eyes because I wasn't even sure I knew what the eyes were like. So it turns out they have two compound eyes and three simple eyes. And the simple eyes just are sensitive to light. And then the compound eyes, you know, see all these multiple images. So I'm sort of imagining this creature sitting there seeing very bright kaleidoscopes of sugar. Quite a wonderful image. Anyway, I wanted to bring up Gary Snyder here because he's so good about helping us think about animals. I interrupt the poem to quote Gary Snyder just because I love him so much. So he says, do you really believe you're an animal? Many people have not absorbed the implications of this. They're not sure they're animals. They like to feel they might be something better than animals. And that is understandable. Other animals might feel they're something different than just animals too. That's so great. So, but he says, we must contemplate the shared ground of our common biological being before emphasizing the differences. So I think that's what she's doing here. I think she's helping us share our common biological being. Anyway, back to the poem. So I don't know exactly what prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I've been doing all day. So, I don't know if she's Buddhist, but this sort of sounds like what Zen teachers tell you to do, to pay attention. And I would just say, my confession, I do not find it easy to be idle. I work. I am busy, and I take this seriously. I mean, I wrote on the thing on the refrigerator. On my refrigerator, it's like, busyness is the enemy of blessedness. It's like, why am I always so busy? I have to rush off to the Zen Center to meditate. Busy, busy, busy. So I just think of this as her telling us, if we do want to make this connection, that we need to pay attention, take the time, kneel down in respect, and open ourselves to an unmediated experience, you know, not on TV, not in a book, maybe not even in a poem. Just go be with it and take the time to do that. And that's a really long... That's my lesson that I need to learn. So the end of the poem, Tigan called this the punchline. It is a punchline. It punches you right in the nose. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? So, just now thought about Aitken Roshi. I read some of the obituaries, and a lot of them said something like, he lived a really good life. It was talking about he had chosen to live a really good life, 93 years or something. So that's, to me, that's what this last part is about. It's about, so we're going to die, so what? That's not news to us, but we do have this choice, and our life is precious. And I love the idea that it's wild. It's not some it's and to me that's just telling us we are part of nature. We're not just because we're civilized doesn't mean we're not, and that's a good thing to connect with. And to me, that's the question that we sit with on our cushions. Of what are we going to do with our one wild and precious life? I just never said it so beautifully before, but now I have those beautiful words to sit with. So I just wanted to say one more thing about Mary Oliver. Here's what she says about writing poetry. She says, "The world, moist and bountiful, calls to each of us to make a new and serious response. That's the big question the world throws at you every morning. Here you are, alive. Would you like to make a comment?" So that's what she considers her poets to be. So I would ask you, would you like to make a comment? So they're like 400 million years old. Isn't that amazing? I mean, when they evolved on the planet, a couple orders of magnitude before we were they're still around. Yeah, they're pretty spectacular. So you read that, you knew that poem.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I read a lot of Mary Oliver, really. But I really appreciated hearing you read. It carries something different. Like I think poetry should be read aloud. Like it carried so much. Your voice carried so much of the content that my voice, I think, carries differently. And I really appreciate hearing your voice say it.
Yeah, I think that's true. I sort of feel weird sitting at home reading poems aloud, but probably a good idea.
It is like a punchline, Mary Oliver's poems. There's actually on our website a talk I did about Mary Oliver's poems that you can listen to, which I read a few of them, but they all have somewhat of the same structure as haiku. You know, there's a scene in nature, and she, of course, does more than two lines worth of it, but she takes a scene and gets into it, and then there's something that happens that she realizes something. This is the kind of classic structure of a haiku, a snapshot of nature, and then some new awareness. So Basho did it with a frog. An ancient pond, frog jumps in, plop, or sound of water. I think Eiken Roshi translated it as plop. He has a book, one of his many good books is on Basho. So, yeah, but the point that you were making about our being part of nature, our being animals, is I think very important in terms of appreciating this one wild life that we have to use here. So, thank you for sharing that. Please, other people, responses, comments.
I liked Gary Snyder's quote.
Yeah.
Because I wonder what other animals think.
Right.
Frequently. I wonder what they're thinking about us, and are we that much different? Like, I really wonder. I really wish we could just kind of talk to each other.
Really?
Hang out and hang out by the fire. And like, talk. I don't know.
There's a passage in Gary Snyder, I think it may be in passage in Practice of the Wild, where he talks about all the animals come to see the strange human beings, and they're a little afraid of us, but they like to hear us sing and chatter, and so they hang out around the outskirts of the fire to
see all the eyes. Yeah, exactly.
Because they're curious. They want to know, what are these strange human-type animals? What are they up to? What are they doing? They're curious about us.
There's on that same line, there's a Far Side cartoon of a bear standing behind a tree looking at a hunter going, why is this guy, why is he shooting at me? Wondering, what's this guy doing? What have I done to him? Mm-hmm. That same idea of what are we doing to another animal?
Far Side is one of the best things to connect people with nature. I think I use a lot of this cartoon because they're very... they're not scary in any way. It's like, okay, everyone wants to read something funny, but they really do put ideas into your head that weren't there before.
Mm-hmm. Birds see the world.
Right. Little
targets on everyone's heads.
Does not being able to use language allow just knows how to just be. It's nice to have her at work. It's nice to have her there because the lack of language somehow is a comforting thought to see the freeness there. We use the cartoon and the connection to nature to help us to empathize. It's interesting to think about, but to actually think about what it would be like to not have the language and the power of the negative and gaining ideas that language brings upon us, the agendas.
Thank you so much. That's a wonderful thing to say. So grasshopper's brain is just like a few ganglia, it's like a big brain. It doesn't have to have all these dumb ideas and stuff. It could just be. On the other hand, it has those eyes. It's really interesting to think. Is that where we're getting to? Is we're trying to drop all these ideas? Grasshopper brain. Grasshopper mind. I don't know. Is that like mind of clover? Every organism is so complicated in the way it functions as an organism and then interacts with so many things around it. And so many of those complicated things are not driven by a mind, the kind of consciousness that humans have. Plant will have nodules on its roots that can take nitrogen out of the air and turn it into nitrogen in the soil, but it's not thinking about it or putting it on its to-do list for the day. It's just a different way of being in the world that seems pretty attractive sometimes. Not all the choices.
Well, our practice is to just sit silently. And that does, I think you're right, Phil, help us go beyond language. Our language is, you know, how we think, and it does separate us. We have subjects and verbs and objects, and we think of the world as things out there, and our language helps us to arrange things and discriminate and construct things and make things into things. Part of poetry and koan language is that it unlanguages us. Mm-hmm. Poetry is a way of speaking that actually calls up the silence or just the eyes of the grasshopper. Nathan?
So I've had the opportunity to see Laurel in the wild, and it's, I can confirm she's a very busy person. There's absolutely an accurate term described. So it's nice to be able to see Laurel become more grasshopper-like.
Thank you, Nathan. Self-knowledge is the first step.
This made me think of, for whatever reason, I can really connect with trees. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why, I've made it practice to sit in lots of trees. And, not sure why that is, but just kind of the swaying and paying attention to it. I don't know what it does, but recently I moved from a really busy apartment to a more quiet apartment with a little garden, and just waking up with green around me is so much nicer. And that reminded me of, felt like sometimes in my best moments when I'm watching trees, and it's like that poem. And never really thinking about it. But I don't know why, maybe it's evolution. We're not used to this yet. But
Jim?
Ecosystems, the scientist looks closer and closer. Resolve or dissolve into systems within systems within systems. With no privileged center or start or director in it at all. Oops, there are forms of life within us. Again, which work out as non-centered systems in the notion of the Buddhist or I guess Hindu terms of the net of
silence. I want to add, just for balance, to put in a good word for busyness. So our practice is about, in many ways, Zen practice, sitting just facing the wall, being present, quiet, listening to what it's like to be this body and mind on this cushion or chair, is unlanguaging our language, is getting unstuck from the ways in which we discriminate. But then, you know, well, here we all are living in Chicago in the world. But really, as human monkeys, as human animals, you know, our way of being animals may be in some ways to chatter and use our hands and do things and make decisions and discriminate. And so our practice includes that. How do we, you know, like the last line, could you read the last section again, please, of Mary Oliver's fine poem, just the part about death and what are we going to do?
Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?
So, Zen is about questioning, and this is a wonderful question, and each of us has our own answer, and it's important to actually touch the quiet and the non-busyness and let go of all of the chattering and feel that deep connectedness that the word ecology is about interconnectedness, and that Jim was talking about and that you were talking about. But what are we going to do with this one life? So it doesn't mean that we have to get busy, but how do we appreciate the opportunity to express something that includes both the quietness and our animal nature? So we've been talking about Buddha nature, we can also talk about animal nature. And how do we share this in the way that you know, responds to that question that Mary Oliver is asking? What's the most beautiful way for you to live your life, you know, today, this week, this month, this lifetime? And, you know, for some of us at times we might get busy with various projects. And if we do, it's very important to remember our sponsor, the Buddha sitting up there quietly. So I've said it, all of the Buddhist sutras and koans and commentaries are all commentaries on silence. And yet here we are, we human monkeys in the world. How do we use this life? I appreciate very much your bringing Mary Oliver to us again. Are there other just comments or responses or questions? And some of the new people people who haven't spoken yet this evening, please feel free. We just are here talking together, so any comments or responses are welcome.
You said that Chicago does have some wonderful and amazing nature places.
Yeah.
And it's true, like I go out and I ride the bike and I enjoy the park and just the different greenery that's around. But sometimes in the city, amongst all the hustle and bustle and all the fumes and the litter, it's hard to feel at one with the earth or feel like she's your friend when you're just covered in so much stuff.
Yeah. I think we should fix that. I think we can't. I mean, it doesn't have to be that bad.
That's what you're busy in?
Yeah. So get busy. But I really appreciate you saying that because it's so much a choice and not a you know, and necessity that it has to be that way. And, you know, in the actual city of Chicago, there's a lot of, well, I don't want to be cynical and say it's lip service, but there is a lot of greening that goes on, and, you know, and I think that's all really good, but it's so not enough. And I don't think it's up to the city to do it. I think it's up to all of us to do it. And we can take a little ugly place and make it a little nicer without too much effort, you know? Just so, yeah, it's... we live near this gorgeous lake, and we have a river, parkways, and butterflies. And so, yeah, stop putting poison on our lawn and let the clover grow. The rabbits eat it. So, yeah, it's great that you're on your bike, because if you're on your bike, you could at least see and smell it instead of being in a car where, yeah, it's all mediated by the car environment. There's...
Can I just offer a counterpoint, which is I honor that there's so much we can all do to make it more alive, you know, with green things in Chicago. 2 years ago, I went to Burning Man, which happens in the middle of the desert. It's like nothing lives in this dried out lake bed. And so I was in a place where there's literally no life. Like, nothing can live there. Not even desert creatures. Nothing lives there. Everything that's out there during this thing is brought out there. And so after that experience, being in this place of dust for several days, when I came back to Chicago, it was so alive. There was so much green and so much... So I lost that perception. I did hold the perception that the city was dead for a long time until I went out. You know, to a place where there was no life. And then I came back here and I was like, God, it's amazing. Chicago's amazing.
Yeah, it's a rich place. I was just responding to the things that he doesn't like.
Yeah.
I think he can fix those things.
Well, I can relate, but I just, you know,
okay.
I've been through the events here. I got involved in Chicago from power ordinance. And it's funny being roughly 35 votes to get this passed and then, you know, see what the mayor does. But they have five aldermen in it. In a matter of a couple weeks, they had 13. Now they just got another in Portland, 14. And, you know, once they have 26, they're getting close because it's the majority of getting into the floor. And basically what it does is it forces two power companies that are the hugest stationary sources, the largest stationary sources of pollution in Chicago, equivalent to 872,000 cars of pollution, that are 1910 power plants burning coal and just creating 18,000 cases of asthma a year, and I even diagnosed with asthma last year. And I work 3 blocks from home. So I'm pretty passionate about it. And I'm working with one of the aldermen, the important alderman, after birth, and his daughter, who's his chief of staff. But it's funny because they're, the support, as you talk to people, it's just a no-brainer. They're like, of course we need to force to clean it up. You know, and the arguments against are very weak. They're very weak, and it's easy to get someone to sign a petition to convert. And the momentum is there. It's started now, but I guess the point is that the awareness is all it takes is shine a little light on it for somebody and they convert.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very simple argument. So I'm surprised at how easy it is to change a mind. You know, now that I'm doing it with clients and things. And I'm kind of like, why wasn't this done like 2002 or something? In 2010, this is still turning out pollution, now that I know the stats. So I think that takes it to the power of just us being aware and picking our issue in our territory and getting the action, because the apathy has allowed the Midwest generation to just keep these things running and polluting the heck out of Chicago. And it causing 41 deaths a year, and I mean, it's just amazing. You know, over 180 jobs. That was the argument, losing jobs. Like, 41 deaths, 180 jobs. I wonder which one I would pick. No. So anyway, it's just really opened my eyes, like, to just how easy it can be to to just take action and really force change. So,
thank you for doing that.
Thank you for sharing that, Phil. And for anyone who wants to follow up on what Phil's talking about, there are some flyers by the front door on the little table there about the Chicago Clean Power campaign and ordinance. And yeah, there are things that can be done that have a big impact right here in our, you know, in our city. So thank you for working on that, Phil. I'm sorry, is it Catherine? You had something Carolyn. Yeah, you were going to say something before. That's okay, you can go back.
I was just going to comment on the beginner's mind and what was the grasshopper. I was wondering if anyone had ever thought about an animal's mind as being the pride of language, as being the almost like ultimate beginner's mind, because they can't really comprehend anything other than their existence, being not self-aware, like monkeys and elephants and dolphins are self-aware, but other animals aren't. So would that automatically give them the awareness and opposite sense of a mind in which they have no worries? I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, we can take, Mary Oliver took a grasshopper as a teacher, and we can learn just to enjoy being here. Great ancestor Nanchuan Zhaozhou's teacher said that the Buddha ancestors don't know what it is. Cats and cows know what it is. So, Dawn, you had something?
I was just going to point out that she had a question.
Well, thank you all very much. Thank you, Laurel, for your expression and bringing us back to our animal nature and to pay attention to grasshoppers. Thank you, Brooks, for your enjoyment of grasshoppers.